I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. In back-to-back debates this week, 20 Democrats vying to be the presidential candidate to take on President Trump in 2020 met in Detroit. On Tuesday night, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, the leading progressives, took on the moderates on everything from health care and immigration to college debt, climate change, the economy, and foreign policy. Last night, Vice President Joe Biden, the frontrunner, was in the crosshairs, sparring with Senators Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Michael Bennett, former HUD Secretary Julian Castro, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, Governor Jay Inslee, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, and entrepreneur Andrew Yang on some of the same topics. The big difference was Biden's long track record on crime, trade, criminal justice, race, abortion, and his association with President Obama. Curiously, the candidate seemed more critical of Obama's policies on health care and immigration last night than they did on Trump's. So what did we learn this week? What does it say about the Democratic Party and the upcoming election with President Trump? Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Imani Perry. She is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Imani, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Matthew Kerbel is with us as well, I should say, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. Matthew, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
And joining us by telephone is Jonathan Tamari. He's Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jonathan, it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. Whoops, we will get Jonathan squared away once we get our conversation started. And let me just open up the lines to our listeners, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. And Jonathan, we have you, correct?
Yes. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you all with us. Let me begin with a kind of basic question here. I always try to imagine that as I'm watching these debates that I'm tuning in for the very first time. I've heard of maybe a couple of these candidates, but not all of them. I don't really know anything about their various position papers and policies. And Matthew, assuming I'm that person, what do you think I would have learned this week?
I think it would have been difficult to wade your way through what you heard, in part because these were offered as debates, but they were, as much as anything, spectacles. And the format didn't really lend to the generation of light. And in particular, if you look at the way some of the questions were framed to pit the candidates against one another, they were really designed to generate heat. So I don't think that a viewer who's turning in for the first time trying to make sense of the candidates would really have been able to wade through to the level of detail that's necessary to understand some of the significant and serious issues on the table.
Imani, we're talking about 20 people, 10 people each night. That's a lot of heavy lifting.
It is. It's very difficult, I think, to keep track of the individual candidates and also to keep track of the issues with that many people. And given that, and this is something we were talking about prior to being on air, given that the question asking was so intensely focused on trying to generate a kind of battle royale between the candidates, there was less kind of nuanced discussion and a lot of time spent back and forth, that's right, that's wrong. And I think it would be, for very complex issues that really would be better sort of vetted by virtue of reading or having a kind of extended description, and certainly not in the context of 60 seconds. I will say that one thing I thought was very interesting about both nights is that it turned out to be a kind of referendum on the new Democrat of the 90s. Right. And so the shift for the Democratic Party to remain progressive on social issues, but move towards more conservative frame of reference on the political economy that happened in the early 90s is actually coming up for debate. And we saw that in all of the moments of conflict. And that's interesting.
Interesting sort of what the Democratic Party wants to be, what it will be in the future.
Will it be? There's some kind of real New Deal, going back to New Deal Democrat energy that's in the party right now. And I think that's interesting.
Jonathan, what was your major takeaway from the last couple of days?
The major takeaway is that I don't know that there is one clear takeaway. As you said, if you're somebody who's just tuning in, it's not really clear, I think, what the overall message from Democrats is, which makes some sense since you still have people competing in this primary and voters deciding which message they want to go with. But even when we did see the contests between, say, the real leading liberal voices of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, they were up against a number of moderates who were probably very unknown to most people. And then the next night you had a completely different debate, mm-hmm. which was mostly focused on people attacking each other and taking very kind of arcane, digging into arcane details that I think most people are not following. Rather than having kind of these big visions competing with each other, I don't think we saw much of that, and I don't think we know kind of what the vision that a Democrat is going to offer is right now.
Well, let me play a clip from the first night. It seems like it's, you know, years ago, but nonetheless, it was just Tuesday night. This is Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's criticizing former Congressman John Delaney over his unwillingness to support Medicare for All, and again from Tuesday night's Democratic debate on CNN.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
Matthew, interesting. I mean, that got a lot of play, that particular clip.
Yes, and I think that was, if you were to distill the meaning of the first debate, it was really that. It was about this clash of visions. And I think for the viewer, it's confusing if you go from that debate to what we saw last night. I think we really won't have clarity on these genuine divisions in the Democratic Party until Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are together on the same stage with Joe Biden.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, the three, I guess,
I think
front
so.
Runners, at least at this point. You said Imani.
No, I think that's right. I mean, the ideas that Warren is proposing and Sanders, I mean, and they have some distinction, are really about sort of addressing the depth of economic inequality, right? And this question of whether redistribution is necessary, as we've seen the concentration of wealth in the top 0.1%, as Warren talks about. But that sort of crystallizing as an issue hasn't happened yet on the debate stage.
Let me play one more clip from Tuesday night, and this is Senator Bernie Sanders. He's criticizing actually the moderator, Jake Tapper's question, which was, will taxes go up for the middle class in a Medicare for All system? And let's give that a listen.
What I am talking about, and others up here are talking about, is no deductibles and no co-payments. And Jake, your question is a Republican talking point. At the end of the day, and by the way, the healthcare industry will be advertising tonight on this program.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Warren, it's your turn.
Oh, can I complete that, please?
Your time is up, 30 seconds.
They will be advertising tonight with that talking point.
Jonathan, there's a lot going on there in that we've got the clock going, and Sanders obviously trying to put out an important point from his perspective.
Yeah, and I mean, the clock was one of the features, I think, of the first night that drove a lot of people crazy, and I think they were a little more loose with it on the second night as they tried to give people a chance to explain what are pretty complicated topics. And that line from Senator Sanders about people using a Republican talking point is something that came up pretty frequently, not just in regards to the moderators, but in with Democrats attacking each other for criticizing each other's ideas. And it's an odd one, though, because even though it might be, the point is that I think in these debates that there are differences between these candidates. And so the part of the point is to draw out those differences so people can decide who they like, you know, to take on President Trump if you are a Democrat. And also that if it's a Republican talking point, it means that you're probably going to face that criticism if you get to the general election. So This is a chance for people to defend themselves against that talking point.
You know, I thought it was curious. I expected, especially last night, but also on Tuesday night, I expected more of the Democrats, frankly, to go after President Trump, especially after his week of, frankly, racist comments about members of Congress, four women, one man in the last couple of days. I'm looking at you, Matt, but Imani, and also to you, Jonathan. I just felt like people pulled their punches, and I wasn't exactly sure why.
Well, you have 20 people on the stage, and about 15 of them are struggling to be on the stage again next time. So you know, when that's the central dynamic, then you know, it's it may not work strategically to the advantage of candidates who are looking to make a splash to go against Donald Trump. In particular, last night when Joe Biden was on the stage, mm-hmm. and you had a number of candidates who were basically looking to find a way to either either challenge his frontrunner status or build themselves up. So to this point about Obama and the Obama administration, you know, Biden is really running with the Obama legacy as a shield. So when you have candidates who are looking to pierce that, it can come across as attacking Obama. I strongly suspect that once this stage is over, that's not going to be an issue for Democrats.
Go ahead, Imani.
I think that that's probably right. But something has shifted in the country in the aftermath of a lot of forces, right? So from Occupy Wall Street to Black Lives Matter to more recently sort of a lot of activism around immigration, the base of the Democratic Party is not where it was. And as a consequence, the politics of returning to what was this period, I think, of some kind of safety in the Democratic Party, of sort of having figured out a model that a lot of people could buy into, right, from various political perspectives, isn't necessarily there. The sort of, and I think that's actually a big part of where Joe Biden is floundering, although he's still the front runner, but is that there's a large sector that does not want to go back to the Obama era or the Clinton era, right? That wants to actually have some new vision of what how the society should be organized. And just one more point is that, you know, one of the first night it kept the dynamic was all these new proposals are unrealistic. This is unrealistic. But we're in such a strange historical moment that actually, because everything feels unrealistic in terms of what's going on presently in the administration, that I think maybe it opens up people's imaginations a little bit more. Right?
Well, but it came across as if Obama was part of the establishment, and perhaps he is, although we know he's usually popular among Democrats. So it's a curious position that he's in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that to the extent that Obama wasn't establishment, I think he was establishment in many ways in terms of his sort of economic and foreign policy. I think he was not establishment in terms of really pushing the party to be more progressive on social issues. I think there's no question. So, you know, we've shifted focus. Part of that has to do with Sanders and his impact at the last election. He changed the discourse of the Democratic Party pretty profoundly. You know, and part of it has to do with a lot of social and political transformations on the ground.
And probably Trump as well.
Yes.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Imani Perry, Matthew Kerbel, and Jonathan Tamari. And we are talking about the two Democratic debates this week in Detroit on Tuesday night, Wednesday night. 10 candidates at each debate. Add them up, 20 people, a lot to talk about. Join the conversation at phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jonathan Tamari. He's Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, joining us by telephone. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio, Matthew Kerbel. He's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Villanova University, and Imani Perry, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Jonathan, let me get you in on the conversation. Then we've got a bunch of people that want to join us, and I've got some comments here as well. How do you see, picking up on both what Imani and Matthew were saying before the break, sort of how the Democratic Party, I guess, is struggling with its identity, how much it draws on the past or even on Obama himself, and where you think it moves going forward, knowing that there are all these forces at play?
So I think that both Matthew and Imani touched on some points about what has really changed, even in the relatively brief time that since President Obama was in office. I think a lot of people, a lot of activists at least, saw President Trump win campaigning on ideas that most people thought would never win the presidency. And so I think it has expanded their idea of what they think can win. If they're basically saying, if he can win campaigning on what he did, why don't we campaign on some of our biggest ideas? And so that has, and I think as well, Senator Sanders also kind of showed that there is a constituency for that in the way that he ran with some ideas that were completely outside the mainstream a few years ago, Medicare for All being the clearest example that now Democrats either are fully embracing or trying to get, at least get close to in some way. So I think that that is a huge factor. But I also think that there is that we're in a moment right now where the activist part of the party seems to have a voice that might be louder than a lot of the actual voting base of the party, as illustrated by the fact that even though Joe Biden is not the most popular among some of the most liberal voices, or if you're on social media, when he's consistently leading in the polls. And so I think the party is kind of torn between this very vocal, very active group and a quieter group that still might be a little more moderate than is being portrayed.
Well, and let me just add to that. I was reading that a majority of Americans oppose the elimination of private health care coverage. They also oppose federal health care for undocumented immigrants. They oppose decriminalization of legal border crossings and oppose reparations. So you've got this very vocal core of the Democratic Party, Matthew, and then you've got the rest of America, it seems.
Well, I think the question hovering over this election is whether this is a paradigm-shattering moment. Mm. And the answer to that question, I think, will determine which way the Democratic Party ultimately goes, and they're going to have to sort that out. Because if this were an election like we've seen in the past, a typical election, then the Biden message, which is the let's return to the status quo under Obama approach.
And tweak things around.
And tweak things around, but right. Or others who were making the point that some of the bolder plans are just too unrealistic, they can't happen. The assumption underlying that approach is that we are in more or less ordinary times, and Democrats are missing an opportunity if they go too far. But the argument that's being made by Warren and Sanders is that, in fact, the rules have changed. The country is not where it was even a couple of years ago, and that the way to move forward is to understand what made Donald Trump possible and to go after that. In other words, bold, dramatic change.
Iman, you want to add to that? Now I'll read a bunch of comments that we've got here and we'll get some callers in.
Yeah, I think that's right. I also, you know, the thing about sort of public opinion is so complicated because overwhelmingly what we see is when there is a benefit that is accorded to the general public, that while it may be unpopular at the beginning, it soon thereafter becomes popular with Americans, right? We actually do like the welfare state as long as it's not targeted towards the most vulnerable, unfortunately, right? And so I think that there is something actually wise about having that fight and potentially winning it. I also think that, you know, we have the country is the ultra right has the country by the throat. I mean, they're so overrepresented in terms of every aspect of our political lives. And so I think this contrast of sort of not being held hostage, but actually trying to present a vision that is sort of broadly inclusive of everybody, but the most elite, is something that will have a dramatic impact, even if Biden is the nominee, because he will have to move somewhat to the left if he is going to be the nominee. And also, just as the last point, he's leading, but he doesn't have the majority.
Right.
Right. And that is an important distinction, too, because there are a number of charismatic voices who are to the left of him.
And there is time. I mean, the election is more than a year away.
Right.
Let me read some comments. One from Joseph. I have made up my mind. I'm not interested in the debates, at least not at this point. There's just too many candidates right now, all trying to score points with voters. Just not interested in that. A comment from Rachel says, I like Harris, but her history as a prosecutor gives me great pause. Frankly, I prefer not to choose a white man. A comment from Annabelle. I've made my two choices. I'm going to struggle at the polls to figure out who to pick, but I narrowed it down, the rest can go away. I mean, I think a lot of people are saying, too many choices. Can I just throw out a poll question? And Matthew, I'll toss this to you. It seems it's so early to ask someone, well, who was your favorite candidate? Why not say, who are your top three? Wouldn't that be more realistic and reflective about sort of where the people are, rather than having to pick that one person that you want to be president?
Or who are you considering is a good question, as opposed to who are you not considering, which gives a sense of how the various candidates are registering. But you're absolutely right to be cautious about polls, even polling averages at this point, because here we are in the middle of summer, the year before the election. Some people have engaged. I think there's a tremendous amount of interest in general, but to have engaged in the particulars to the point where people are really following these candidates, I think is a lot to ask of the public. Mm-hmm. So at this stage of the game, I think polling can be useful to gauge candidate trajectories, who's rising and who's falling. And I think it gives you a rough sense of who people know at this point. But beyond that, to try to predict the horse race outcome with the polls would be foolish.
How much, as a reporter, Jonathan, how much do you pay attention to polls?
I think similar to what Matthew just said, it helps tell you the kind of the course that people are on, who's gaining, who's slipping. If a certain moment resonated, the polls give you, you know, a more scientific look at that than just the instant pundit reaction the night of the debate. But I agree that it's way too early to use these to kind of predict what's going to happen. It more is giving us a sense, I think, of kind of who is really in the mix and who is not, and who's maybe has a chance to become part of the mix right now, without really issuing any kind of conclusions. As Guy said, a lot of these candidates are still getting known. Vice President Biden probably has a lot of residual support just from being associated with Barack Obama for 8 years. And so I think that there's still a lot to shake out between now and when voters actually start voting in the caucuses and the primaries next year.
We are talking about this week's back-to-back debates among the Democrats vying for the presidential nomination. And that's Jonathan Tamari, also with us Matthew Kerbel and Imani Perry. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play a clip from last night. This is Senator Cory Booker and Vice President Joe Biden. It's a heated exchange over criminal justice reform.
Why did you announce on the first day a zero tolerance policy of stop and frisk and hire Rudy Giuliani's guy in 2007 when I was trying to get rid of the crack cocaine?
Mr. Vice President, there's a saying in my community, you're dipping into the Kool-Aid and you don't even know the flavor. You need to come to the city of Newark and see the reforms that we put in place. The New Jersey head of the ACLU has said that I embraced reforms, not just in action, but in deed.
There weren't a lot of memorable moments, Imani, last night, but we pulled that one out.
Yeah.
It's significant? I mean, we should say that Cory Booker hired Carrick from New York, right, to be his... And yes. He has got some baggage.
Not Bernie Carrick. I believe it was Jerry McCarthy.
My mistake. Thank you for fixing it. Thanks, okay. Jonathan.
I mean, well, one, it's such a Generation X moment because that, I mean, all up in the Kool-Aid and don't know the flavor is very much my generation. So for the younger people, I'm sure they were like, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
You know, what was interesting about that moment and other moments, and they were both right. I mean, there's a lot to critique in terms of Biden's record on criminal justice, and there's a lot to critique in terms of Booker's and Harris's. I mean, so there some of this back and forth, even though it was constructed in a way that I think was often problematic and sniping, but the ways in which the Democratic Party has been implicated in mass incarceration is a huge issue, and members of the party who have been involved for a long time are going to have baggage. Yeah. And we need to talk about it. The question is how. Yeah.
It also includes the Congressional Black Caucus.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, just to sort of add to the to the complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you want to add to that, Matthew?
Well, I think it speaks to the politics of the last 40 years and how things are changing and really changing quite quickly.
How about for you, Jonathan? Anything you want to, from your perspective, how that played and what the messages, I guess, were coming out of that interchange?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I was looking for heading in. Senator Booker has been critical of Biden for several weeks now, starting with his comments about Biden's comments about the segregationist senators, and then continuing to criminal justice reform, which was really teed up very well for Booker, because that has been the issue he has probably spent the most time working on as a senator. And it's really kind of the signature topic that he's tried to bring out as a senator. And so he was really looking for this confrontation. He's a candidate who has a lot of positive features, a lot of potential, but who just has had no traction in the polls yet, and was really looking for last night to be a chance for him to break out, being on stage with Biden and Harris. And you know, I know his campaign thinks he did really well and is was very excited by that line in particular, of being able to show that he can fight, but also kind of do it with a little bit of humor and a little bit of a smile, of being kind of a happy warrior as they see it.
And Imani, I noticed he was one of the few that kept coming back to President Trump. I
mean, yes.
Not in a big way, mm-hmm. but he would just sort of steer the conversation back to the president.
Yeah, and I think that was useful. I will say, you know, one of the things that I found myself wishing, and maybe this was unrealistic, is that in some of these moments, if some of the candidates had said, you know, I was wrong on this issue and I underwent a transformation, that would have been incredibly refreshing, because the consequence of no one wanting to make those kinds of admissions is that we had this moment of saying, who's telling the truth, right? I didn't do that. I didn't do that. That's not what, you know. And I understand that kind of defensiveness in the political landscape, but it did kind of muddy things up. But yes, he did. And he said ultimately, we're generally on the same side, and mm-hmm. we all are trying to defeat Trump. And I think that was a good reminder.
I'm so glad you said that, because and Biden and others, they're not the only ones that seem to have a hard time admitting they made a mistake. And it
right.
seems to be so, you could frame it and say, if I had known the intended consequences
right.
of the crime bill, I wouldn't have done it, or I would have
right.
done it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like there is a way to say this where you can almost save face, but also be honest.
Right.
Matthew,
I think that's right. I suspect the reason that we didn't hear that is because at this stage of the race, I think some of the candidates, especially the front-running candidates, are strategically thinking that if they were to do that, then they're giving opponents an opening.
Right.
But I don't know if that's wise. I think that especially for candidates who have a record. Biden clearly has a very long legislative record. He's trying to explain or defend positions that he took at a time when the politics of the moment, regardless of what you think of them, when those politics made sense for him to make those choices. I think he's trying to defend that without acknowledging mm-hmm. that maybe perhaps if things had been different, that he would have acted differently, that perhaps knowing what he does now, some of the choices he made were mistaken. And I wonder if we are going to start to hear language like this as the field narrows and the debate sharpens.
Jonathan, you cover these candidates. What do you think?
I think that it's an unfortunate aspect of politics that very few politicians ever apologize, which makes them seem so different from just, you know, the regular people who you interact with on an everyday basis.
We are fallible, seem, you know.
Right, but it makes them seem distant. I think there's this fear that if you admit, you concede that you did something wrong, that it then legitimizes the criticism against you in the first place. But I do think that a lot of people, it kind of turns people off. It's just another aspect that makes them seem not normal in some ways to some people.
Let me get Vicki from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Vicki, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. My point about Medicare for All is that there are hidden people who will suffer. I'm a licensed professional counselor, which is different from a social worker. Our education as licensed professional counselors is much more extensive in clinical work. Social workers do more case management and so forth. But we are not covered by Medicare at all. I rely on independent insurance for my income. I'm 67, and I don't have the longevity to go back to school to now
sure.
get another master's.
And I hear you, Vicki. What you're saying is it sounds like that Medicare for All wouldn't, you're part of the medical system and it wouldn't necessarily work for you. And I think that's one of the criticisms, Matthew, of Medicare for All, which is that it covers something like 80% of costs. And you know, is it the system that can really dig us out of the mess that we're in?
And how is Medicare for All presented to the public, too? Because I think there's confusion over this. And you have different candidates who are using that phrase, but not always using it in the same way. This is an extraordinarily difficult and complicated discussion. And you know, to go back to the debate two nights ago, I thought it was really it was prominent both nights, but especially on Tuesday night. And I thought when you did have this discussion with Warren and Sanders leading the defense of their understanding of Medicare for All, I thought that for a moment at least there was some semblance of an actual debate to try to shine some light on it, but in a format where you have a minute to speak and you're
15-second rebuttal.
And the questions are being framed in a way to generate maximum heat. It's really extraordinarily difficult.
A comment from Joe. I think the second debate showed that Medicare for All is an issue that isn't going to work well in the general election. That's something that more moderate candidates have shown. Also a comment from Pam. I keep hearing about how Joe Biden is able to take votes from Trump, and I just don't think he'll be able to do that. I know that he's ahead in the polls right now, but so was Hillary, and she lost.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Jonathan Tamari, Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Matthew Kerbel, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Villanova University, and Imani Perry. She's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. All three joining us as we talk about this week's presidential debates, I should say, plural, among the Democrats, 20 candidates, 10 on Tuesday night, 10 last night. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and again talking about this week's debates among the 20 Democratic presidential contenders. They all want to be the contender or the candidate to take on President Trump. And if you watched the debates this week, we want to hear from you. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just quickly read a comment from Tina. Politicians don't apologize. I'm a doctor. We never used to apologize. Now there's some research that says that when you apologize, we build trust between us and our patients. So something just to think about out there. Matthew, you wanted to talk about Biden and Trump.
Well, I think this is from the last comment before the break. I think it's a valid question as to whether or not Joe Biden would be the strongest candidate to go up against Donald Trump. Certainly the polling now suggests that he would be. But again, like I said earlier, I think you have to be very careful about using that polling to make predictions about outcomes. The reason I bring this up is because I think it's really dependent on what kind of election cycle we're in. So if we are at a time where the public is looking to be comforted and to return back to the way things were prior to the Trump election, then a candidate like Joe Biden can probably resonate with voters. But if this is a moment of a more pronounced change, an election, say, more comparable to 1980, where people are willing to take
Reagan,
steps.
Right?
That was Reagan against Carter. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Where people are willing to entertain a different direction because for various reasons they feel that they're unhappy with the status quo and they don't necessarily want to go back to what was before it, then Biden wouldn't necessarily be the best candidate to compete against Trump.
Jonathan, let me get you back in on the conversation here. And let's just talk a bit about Pennsylvania. As we know, Pennsylvania was one of the states that narrowly went for a Donald Trump in 2016, frankly, took him over the top. Does Pennsylvania still have that kind of status? And do you see it still playing that battleground state role in, what, 2020?
Absolutely. It is one of the four states, along with Michigan, Wisconsin, and Florida, that you see Democratic super PACs really already targeting with a lot of resources, advertising, messaging. Priorities USA, which is one of the largest Democratic super PACs, has a chart where they kind of list the states from most Republican to most Democratic, and they have Pennsylvania pretty much right in the middle as potentially the deciding vote right now. So it's going to be a huge focus for them. It's already been a huge focus for Republicans. President Trump did a rally in May. Vice President Pence is doing an event this week, I think actually today, in part of Pennsylvania to promote the new trade agreement that the administration has negotiated. So it's a huge focus for both sides, and it was so close, less than one percentage point, that there's any number of factors that could really decide which way it goes this time.
Imania, I think it was Senator Booker talked about the role of black voters in the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and in particular female black voters as really the most sort of loyal of the Democrats. Do you think the party does enough for black women?
Absolutely not. I mean, and never has. And he also talked about voter suppression, which is a huge issue, not just on national elections, but even in local elections. And so I do think it was one of the issues that should have gotten more play and should get more play because, you know, if we take, for example, Stacey Abrams' election, and she lost, but the strategy of actually reaching out to voters who have just been assumed to not be invested, right? If you actually make the election meaningful to large numbers of African Americans and Latinx folks and working class folks who generally don't vote, then the sort of conventional wisdom about where the party is could shift, right? And so, I mean, I think the combination of those forces about thinking. So on the one hand, yes, black women are the most loyal constituency. Black women vote at high rates in national elections, et cetera. But there's also a kind of significant untapped reservoir that is worth engaging.
And might help us understand some of these shifts in the party or some of the issues that seem to be resonating.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Matthew, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that there has long been a tendency among some in the Democratic Party to say that precisely because black voters are such a loyal constituency, you can take them for granted. And I think in particular when you follow that with a strategic perspective that suggests that perhaps not addressing the issues that are most pertinent to black voters, black women voters, that it makes it easier then to reach out to white working class voters. I think one of the things that's being challenged, and was challenged in the first night's debate by Sanders and by Warren, was that approach, that the party really needs to listen to its voters. And it needs to respond to its voters, and that by doing so, you can motivate people. They'll want to come out and vote for you.
Let me play one more clip, and this is from last night's debate. This is New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, and he is challenging former Vice President Joe Biden over the Obama administration's record on immigration and deportation. Let's give it a listen.
But I don't hear an answer from the Vice President. I'm confused. I asked the Vice President point blank, did he use his power to stop those deportations? He went right around the question. Mr. Vice President, you want to be President of the United States. You need to be able to answer the tough questions. I guarantee you, if you're debating Donald Trump, he's not going to let you off the hook. So did you say those deportations were a good idea? Or did you go to the president and say, this is a mistake, we shouldn't do it? Which one?
I was vice president. I am not the president. I keep my recommendation in private. Unlike you, I expect you would go ahead and say whatever was said privately with him.
I mean, this is another one of these issues, Imani, right?
Yes.
I mean, under Obama, and he was called the deporter-in-chief.
He absolutely was.
But here we are in 2019 and children in cages.
Children in cages, right, which in some sense is an extension, and also the expansion of executive power under the Obama administration has really deleterious effects in under the Trump administration, right? These are I think these are meaningful issues. I do, you know, I'll say this. It's also another one of those moments where here's someone who is in some ways pot calling the kettle black, because in terms, you know, there was this discussion around Eric Garner in New York. I mean, as I said before, if they have a record, it probably has some really questionable things on it. I also, just as an aside, in that moment, and it's something that I think is actually an issue for Biden's candidacy overall, he had many moments where he had struggled to complete a thought. He was not coherent. In some ways, that is not wholly different than President Trump. I mean, there's a lot of bombast, but he struggles with coherence and completing thoughts. And I just don't think that is would play well. So I to go back to Matthew's point about sort of this assumption that Biden would be the strongest candidate, I was not convinced last night. It was actually concerning.
Just looking at not just even the
content, but actually how he performed on the debate stage.
And it seems, I mean, you can debate policies and things like that, but for a lot of voters, it's sort of how does someone look and how comfortable are they? Are they having fun? Are they smiling? I mean, these are all maybe subliminal things that resonate with people.
And they're very important. And especially in a debate stage with 20 people over two nights, viewers may pick up those cues as much as they pick up what the candidates say. And for Biden in particular, if his rationale is, I'm a comfortable place to land, I'm the reassuring candidate, then he needs to be reassuring in the way he presents himself.
And you're saying he needs to work on that.
I think it's been an issue for him, not just yesterday, but in other public appearances as well.
Jonathan, an email from Iris. She says, what are the panelists' thought on Andrew Yang? It seems to me he's serious about how to defeat Trump and help all Americans. I mean, he wants to give us a lot of money. That's a winning strategy. I think $1,000 a month per person to the country. It's an interesting idea, a universal basic income. But how do you see people like Yang and Williamson and others that are, you know, on the edges of the stage?
You know, it's the temptation is to say that they're kind of interesting figures who will fade away. But I think a lot of people thought that about President Trump a few years ago. And obviously he's in the White House now. So I don't think we can rule anybody out right now. Yang has qualified for the next round of debates, which will be the qualifications are a little stiffer. So it should be a smaller field debating. And theoretically, that would actually give him a little bit more time. I did see some fairly positive thoughts about him from kind of the pundit class. It is a challenge, I think, though, to still go from an outsider to the White House, even though President Trump did it. I think he's a candidate who will probably get a look, but there is a lot of competition for support right now.
What about some of these other lesser candidates, if I can say that, Matthew?
Well, you know, you can run for president to win, or you can run for president to influence the agenda. Mm-hmm. And I think it's safe to say that there were people on the stage both last night and the night before who perhaps are not going to make a difference in the horse race, but who could make a difference to the narrative. Mm-hmm. I think Jay Inslee is somebody who has not been mentioned but doesn't get a lot of mention up there talking about climate change. It's a huge, huge issue, and it's an issue that moderators have been reluctant to ask about. So if his presence in the campaign is sufficient to change that, then that makes a difference.
Yeah. Imani, anything you want to add to that?
No,
get Brian.
I absolutely would agree with the point about Inslee, and it's hugely important, right? Because all of this that we're fighting for becomes moot if the planet is dead, right? I mean, so And I think with Yang, one of the things that I thought was really interesting about him is that he kept making this point, or maybe it was just twice, but that focusing resentment on the undocumented is incorrect when it's actually a shift in the economy, the economic order. And that has to be asserted in a coherent way by the Democrats, and it just hasn't been. So even, you know, there are figures who make these statements, and it's shifting the agenda, but also clarifying. And part of the sort of benefit of having single issue candidates is that they're clear on those issues, right?
And put them out there and make us talk about them, and make the other candidates at least try to engage with them. Let me get Brian from Middletown, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, love the conversation. Yeah, great. Yeah, your guests are making some really salient points. And, you know, I wanted to quickly comment about the healthcare issue, but just overall, when you just mentioned about Yang and sort of looking at the economy changing, that's my concern with Biden. I mean, I look at him, and incoherence is a good way of describing it. It wasn't just the debate last night, it was the other debate as well. My college-age son, who was watching it with me, said, you know what, Biden should have run 4 years ago. Hmm. That was his window. You know, but I just think it's too late for him. And I do want someone who's younger, who's energetic, who can speak to this changing economy and demographics. And with respect to the health care issue, to me, the most important thing is you have to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, because the Trump administration is obviously trying to demolish it. Strengthen that first. Obviously, try to lower prescription drug costs, offer a public option, but then also allow people to keep their private health insurance if they want to. And you can certainly, there's nothing wrong with doing things gradually. I mean, I'm not one who's against, sure, you know, dramatic change, but at this point, I think we need to be realistic. I think most American voters will be okay with the whole idea. We're going to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, and we're going to build on.
Well, Brian, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I know you call in and you are an enthusiastic listener. I appreciate that. Jonathan, I mean, he hit a bunch of the different points related to the Affordable Care Act or health care in general.
Yeah, and this is one of the most emotionally charged issues for all people, and it's particularly an issue that Democrats have focused on for a long time now. The Affordable Care Act was seen as probably one of the most one of the biggest achievements in a very long time, maybe in a generation for Democrats as far as social policy goes. But already a lot of people are moving past that. Yeah. And it's something that touches everybody's life at some point. But it's also very politically charged. And you see Democrats and Republicans have both paid the price in recent years for their moves on health care. So it is rightly kind of at the center of the debate here. And one of the most clear distinctions I think we do have at this point in a race that's pretty muddled overall.
Almost out of time here, and this is such a small issue, but I just found it so jarring. And I'll put this to you and Matthew, and also to you, Imani, seeing two Tulsi Gabbard ads in the middle of a debate where she's on the stage debating nine other candidates. I just felt like someone at CNN dropped the ball or wasn't thinking straight or something.
It was a little jarring, wasn't it? It was, because here you are in the middle of a debate and then here's this campaign ad that comes on seemingly out of nowhere. I really do have to wonder what they were thinking also.
Yeah. Iman?
No, I mean, for me, it was a sign yet again that I don't think that there should be advertising during debates. It would be wonderful if they were completely publicly funded. I mean, this is a public event. It should be our public sphere, and it's not. It's not. It's shaped by corporate interests.
And if we were to have private debates where we could remove some of the spectacle from what mm-hmm. we do, then maybe we could actually have debates mm. where we can have an exchange of ideas, where candidates have more time to express those ideas, and where the public could actually learn from what they hear.
It's called public media, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, so it is.
Putting on a plug for ourselves here at WHYY. Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Jonathan Tamari, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Matthew Kerbel, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. Imani Perry, always a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming in. And again, she's professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with assistance today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.